This is a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 9, given in Dornach on March 29th, 1920. Yesterday, we discussed how the human organism draws close to outer non-human nature. In the interaction that takes place in two senses, smell and taste, we can see how our human organization establishes a closer connection to what is happening outside in the natural world. We are studying this connection because spiritual science recognizes the need to closely link processes in the human organization to therapeutic procedures. Healing is always a matter of understanding which factors are inherent in what we administer to the body, whether by chemical, physiological, or physical means, and which ones are inherent in what the organism is capable of accomplishing when it is healthy, but not when it is diseased. In our thinking, we must be able to unite the external process and the process taking place within the human organism. Now, these two processes come closest to each other in the perception of smell and taste, while with regard to the other senses, they are further apart. For example, seeing and digestion are quite far apart if what we mean by quote-unquote digestion includes only what happens to food from the time it is chewed in the mouth to the time it is processed by the intestinal glands. This is the whole of my meaning of the term digestion. I would have to consider everything else as an aspect of evacuation, either internal evacuation, parenthesis, or the absorption of substances, close parenthesis, or external evacuation, which I would refer to as elimination. I would count all post-glandular processes as belonging to elimination. Now let us consider seeing. Here, we encounter forms in the outer world that contain within themselves an element that lies closer to the surface in the processes of smelling and tasting. In the process of smelling, this element leaves the realm of non-human nature in order to become perceptible to human beings. In other instances, where this element is enclosed in the substances of the non-human natural world, we look at it. When we look at visible forms and so on, we are encountering the formative principle outside us, the same principle that is also disclosed, but only on the level of substance, in the process of smelling. I would like to suggest that if we trace the being that reveals itself in smell out into the plant or mineral kingdom, we will find that the same principle that becomes evident in smell is revealed in formative processes that take place in the external world of nature. The exact opposite process is digestion. It, quote, takes possession, close quote, of what is revealed in taste, concealing it within the organism again. It is extremely significant to point out that until now we have had to describe outer, non-human nature as lying more in the unconscious. Well, you see the connections that we were able to note from the perspective of the entire universe are present within the human being. The human being is associated with the Saturn-like element, the Jupiter-like element, and so on. But this association is extremely well concealed in the depths of the human organization. If it is not too offensive to modern ways of thinking, we might say that in the human being, the astronomical factor is the least conscious of all the factors. Of all the processes in the organism, it ends up furthest in the background. We also have organs that, quote, open up, close quote, the human organism on the inside in a certain way. These organs bring the human body more into connection with what develops close to our Earth's surface, with meteorology in the broadest sense. If we do not restrict ourselves to looking only at therapeutic substances, but also trace the course of therapeutic processes, we must look at the connections that exist between the human being and meteorological processes in general. At this point, we can distinguish between the human organs that relate more closely to the astronomical factor and those that relate more closely to the meteorological factor. Admittedly, a more refined method of observation must be implemented here. How this distinction must be made will initially shock you somewhat, but as time goes on, you will recognize it as the best possible foundation for healing. If we look at the organs in the human organism that open themselves up to the meteorological factor, in the same way that deeper-lying organs relate to the astronomical factor, the primary organs that we have to consider are the liver and everything that is vesicular in character, everything the bladder represents. Parenthesis, in the context of pathology, the bladder is extremely important. As strange as it may sound at first, the bladder is one of the most important organs to consider in studying pathology. Close parenthesis. In this context, we can also look at the lungs, which are open to the outside, in that they make breathing possible. In a certain respect, we must also consider the heart as one of the organs through which the organism as a whole opens itself up to the outside toward meteorology. You will understand this immediately if you take some things I said in previous lectures in the right way. These organs are all associated with specific meteorological impulses. What this means can be studied only by investigating the human being's entire relationship to the surrounding world, and especially the relationship of human activity to the surrounding world. Above all, I would like to suggest that you make a concerted effort to trace any cardiac damage you encounter to disruptions of human activity. You should conduct studies of how the cardiac function of people who tend their fields as farmers and have little respite from this work differs from that of people whose professions require them to spend a great deal of time driving cars or even riding trains. It would be extraordinarily interesting to set up more thorough research studies on this subject. You would find that the tendency to cardiac disease is especially dependent on whether or not people sit still when they are being transported by some outer vehicle, as is the case with a car or a train. Passive submission to being moved, quote, deforms, close quote, all the processes that are held back in the heart. Let me read that sentence again. Passive submission to being moved deforms all the processes that are held back in the heart. Everything that plays into the human world in this way is related to how human beings maintain bodily warmth. Here you see how cardiac function relates to the impulse of warmth in the outer world to which we are connected. You can see that if an individual engenders enough warmth through his or her own activity, this adequate measure of self-engendered warmth in that person's vital processes is also the measure of the health of the person's heart. With cardiac patients, we would always have to make sure to induce thoroughly enlivened self-movement. I am convinced that in 15 years or so, people will think more calmly about these issues than they do today, and will begin to comment on how remarkable it is that people's cardiac activity has become healthy again through eurythmy, because doing eurythmy essentially regulates ensouled self-movement in accordance with certain laws. Perhaps there is nothing wrong with saying that from this perspective we should point out the healing exercises that can be derived from eurythmy when we are dealing with cardiac irregularities. Next we come to a condition that is more likely to be expressed through reduced bladder activity in the human organism. What I am about to say in this connection may seem somewhat amateurish, but it is not. I can confidently say that it is more scientific than anything that is called scientific today. Essentially, the bladder is a suction device. It functions as a cavity within the human organism, a cavity that creates suction. It is dependent on the fact that the human organism is hollowed out at this particular location. The effect of the bladder on the rest of the organism is just like the effect of a bubble of gas in water. A gas bubble in water is a sphere of dilute matter surrounded by denser matter, and the effect that emanates from this diluted sphere is similar to that of the entire bladder on the human organism. With regard to all the bladder's intended functions, we create disturbances if we have little opportunity to complete internal movements in the right way. One example of this is failing to pay careful attention to the act of eating, disrupting the entire digestive process by gulping down our food instead of chewing. Another is not maintaining the right balance between rest and movement during the digestive process, and so on. Everything that disrupts inner mobility from within also disrupts what we might call the life of the bladder. People will still accept it if you prescribe ensouled movement of some sort for suspected cardiac irregularities, but they will not be very receptive if you want to regulate their inner movements, which are dependent on habit. You will manage to accomplish this, however, if you implement a meteorological treatment for someone who deprives the body of necessary rest by gulping down food or disturbing the digestive process in some other way. This means bringing the person in question into an atmosphere that is richer in oxygen, so that he or she must breathe more and is unconsciously forced to expend more care on the respiratory process. Regulating respiration in this way carries over into the regulation of other organic processes. So you will find that if you either artificially, or better yet, naturally bring an individual who suffers from irregularities in bladder function into a different, more oxygen-rich atmosphere, a certain balance will be effected simply through this change in lifestyle. It is especially important to take note of the liver, the third organ that is connected to outer meteorology in the widest sense. Although seemingly contained within the human organism, it is nonetheless associated with the outer world to a great extent. You can notice this in the fact that liver health is always dependent on the composition of the local water. In order to properly consider the liver health of the people living in a particular place, we would always have to study the composition of the local water. Tasting promotes liver development, but when it occurs in excess, it promotes liver degeneration. In human beings, liver degeneration is the same as excessive indulgence. Finding food pleasant or unpleasant, sympathetic or unsympathetic, ought to be restricted to the tongue and palate, and extending this sympathy and antipathy into the interior leads to liver degeneration. We need to pay attention to this and try to persuade people with any type of liver damage, parenthesis, which is often very difficult to notice, close parenthesis, to investigate taste and to discover something essential in taste. Conducting a thorough study of the interrelationship of liver function to the composition of the water in any particular locality will prove very difficult, since the dependencies are extremely subtle. For example, we would expect liver disorders in localities where the water contains a lot of calcium to be different from those in areas where the water contains less calcium. We will do well to notice this, and to bear in mind that liver function is always supported by eliminating calcium from water as much as possible. Of course, then we must find ways and means of accomplishing this. The life of the lungs is intimately connected to everything a region offers, simply because of its geological configuration. Whether we are dealing with one such as this, where the soil contains a great deal of lime, or an ancient mountainous region, where the soil contains a great deal of silica, human pulmonary function always differs greatly because of such things, since the lungs are essentially dependent on the composition of the solid ground in the locality. One of the first tasks of a physician who establishes a practice in any area should be to thoroughly study the local geology. Studying local geology and examining the local people's lungs are actually the same. We will have to realize that the least favorable situation is when a person's lungs are totally unable to adapt to the local environment. Now, you must not misunderstand what I am saying in this connection. In pointing out the lungs' dependency on the environment, I am not referring to respiration. I mean the internal structure of the lungs themselves. Of course, respiration, in turn, is dependent on good or poor functioning, which is determined by the lungs' internal structure. But with regard to this dependency, I am referring to the actual internal structure of the lungs. Whether a tendency toward incrustation or excessive mucus or the like is present, essentially, depends on the environment. But then the lungs are also very sensitive to physical labor, and will certainly be damaged if a person has to do physical work to the point of excessive fatigue. These are connections that can lead us to recognize the dependent relationships of internal organs, such as the lungs, liver, bladder, and heart, which open up to the outside, toward the meteorological factor. Whenever diseases of these organs are present, we will have to attempt to achieve therapeutic results through physical or naturopathic means. In a certain way, such results are permanent. If we have noticed that someone with a tendency to some sort of lung weakness is quite unadapted to a particular locale, convincing that person to move to a different, more suitable area is often the best thing we can do. Similarly, with regard to the organs located above the lungs, a radical change in domicile and lifestyle is often the greatest possible boon. Such changes do relatively little for the organs that lie below the heart, but they accomplish a great deal for the lungs and all the organs above the lungs. Of course, we must be clear that everything in the organism interacts, and when something goes wrong, we must look for a possible hidden interaction. For example, if we discover cardiac or vascular degeneration, we must ask whether there is any tendency toward pulmonary degeneration that would require us to deal with the illness from that perspective. This at least gives an indication of the human being's relationship to meteorological factors. But behind and masked by meteorological factors in the outer world lie astronomical factors. Like the meteorological factors, they are also present within the human being. Internal meteorological factors encompass only the lungs, liver, bladder, and heart, just as external meteorological factors encompass only the qualities of solid ground, air, water, and warmth. the formative forces of the plant and mineral kingdoms lie behind everything encompassed by ascertainable meteorological factors, both within the human being and in the outer world. These formative forces are very close to the extra-telluric astronomical factor, and their counterpart within the human being is always hidden behind a meteorological process, that is, deeper in the interior than the four above-mentioned organ systems. Because the connection between what is outwardly present in plant and stone and what lies hidden behind the human lungs, liver, and so forth, is not so readily apparent, studying therapeutic processes that have their origin in this realm is naturally considerably more difficult. We can, however, discover a rational way to do this if we realize that in some respects the human being always has an inner organic tendency to do the opposite of whatever is happening externally. Let us take salicylic acid processes as a concrete example. First of all, it is quite evident that salicylic acid processes are taking place wherever silicates, quartz and similar rocks, are formed. These processes have their counterpart in the human organism, but they also underlie certain other activities that, unfortunately, tend to be disregarded today. These other activities take place in cultivated ground and in the interaction between cultivated soil, or the earth as a whole, which is, after all, silicious, and the roots and similar organs that plants sink into the ground. Everything we can derive from plant ashes is also intimately related to the external silica process. This external silica process, however, has its counterpart inside the human being, and specifically in the organs lying above the activity of the heart and tending in the direction of lung activity, if I can put it in this way, or rather of the inner organic activity that shapes the lungs and lies closer to the head. Here, in everything that lies above the activity of the heart, we have the polar counterpart of silica formation in the external world. To a great extent, this inner organic process is essentially a potentization of external silica formation, as I have indicated in previous lectures. A particular symptom complex that has its seat in the area above the heart's activity may lead to all kinds of other disturbances in the organism. Extensive pulmonary discharge is crude evidence of an illness of this sort, but so is meningitis or pseudomeningitis. Because everything is reciprocal in the organism, these lung disorders also influence cardiovascular disorders. Such disturbances may tend toward inflammatory conditions in the brain. However, this tendency may be suppressed and appear instead in the form of inflammation of the digestive organs or related organs. In this case, the problem is knowing where the actual starting point lies, but we can talk more about this later. In all such cases, it will be important to introduce a substance into the organism that dilutes or potentizes the external effects of silica to the greatest possible extent. If you consider this connection in the right way, it proves to be extremely characteristic and important. It also shows you that when something goes wrong that can be directly observed in the upper parts of the body, we need to transform nature's important silica processes by breaking the silica apart, dividing it and grinding it up. If lower parts of the body, such as the heart itself, are damaged as a result of reciprocal effects, then under certain circumstances, the process that is induced by plants containing a great deal of salicylic acid could be used, either directly or in some metamorphosed form, to evoke a healing process. All plants that contain silica compounds should be carefully studied with regard to the extent of their effects on all activities that are played out below the level of the heart in human organism, although of course these effects in turn work back on the rest of the organism. In the external natural world, the complete opposite of silica formation is carbonic acid formation. Carbonic acid formation is the polar opposite of silicic acid formation. This is why it is so necessary to trace the process of carbonic acid formation with respect to everything in the organism that contrasts with what I characterized earlier, that is, everything that has to do with digestion in the broadest sense, or even has its source or starting point in the digestive system. Any carbonic acid compounds, especially if they are used in a natural, plant-derived form, will allow us to cope remarkably well with these forms of illness. It is very important, however, to take one particular connection into account. The sense of smell directs us only outward into the rest of the visible world, while the sense of taste directs us inward toward what lies hidden within the organism. If you trace substances according to what they offer by way of smell and taste, if you study digestion with this in mind, you will realize that at the beginning of the digestive process, substances mingle and flow into one another. As these substances continue to move through our digestive organs, however, we must separate again what has been mingled. This applies not so much to the material aspects as to the respective processes. To separate what mingles when we ingest food is in fact one of the organism's main functions. First of all, it has to separate everything that is meant to be excreted via the bowels on the one hand and via the urine on the other. Medical intuition will be unusually important in treating the system of organs we are now approaching, namely the renal system and its wonderful workings, and the extraordinary branching that is evident there, even on the level of processes. We will say more about this later. At the moment, the important point, as was demonstrated in previous lectures, is that everything eliminated via the bowels has a connection to activities taking place in the head. These two belong together. Similarly, everything eliminated via the urine is connected to processes taking place in and around the heart in the cardiovascular system. In all elimination via the bowels, we are essentially dealing with a human copy of the silica-forming process. While, in all aspects of urine formation, we are dealing with a copy of the carbonic acid process. These connections permit us to conclude that there is a link between what takes place in the healthy individual and what is taking place in someone who is sick. We are pointing toward connections that exist on the level of processes, but these connections cannot be considered in a one-sided manner. We will see that we must master all of these phenomena in order to correctly assess the law of similars that Dr. Scheidegger presented to us in such an illuminating way yesterday. Footnote. In a lecture to participants in this house, Edwin Scheidegger was a leading physician and the builder of the Marian Eislin Hospital in Basel. The, quote, law of similars, close quote, was a basic element of Paracelsus's doctrine of healing and was later put into practice in homeopathy by Samuel Hahnemann, 1755 to 1843, who postulated that medicine produces symptoms in healthy people that are similar to those that it relieves in sick people. End quote. Although it conceals something extremely important, the law of similars needs to be built up out of all the elements we acquire by studying connections such as those we are establishing here. Once again, the human being's connection to metals lies behind everything I have just explained to you. We speak about the silicious quality as what gives form to the human being, in contrast to the dissolving capacity of carbonic acid within the human being. And the process of life itself is inherent in this constant tendency to acquire form and redissolve. If we look first at the silicious quality that gives form to human beings, we must not forget that the particular areas within the human organization that resemble this silicious quality, for reasons I have already explained in part on previous days, have a relationship to the metallic qualities of lead, tin, and iron. Thus we can say that when we look at the area above the heart, we must look at what works within the human being on the basis of silicic acid, on the one hand, and on the basis of the qualities of lead, tin, and iron, on the other. The iron quality has more to do with the lungs' formative process, the tin quality with the head's general formative principle, and the lead quality with the formative force that is localized in the bones, because bone structure and bone growth essentially originate from the upper part of the human being, not the lower part. It is important to learn to weigh how these things work together, how salts of salicylic acid, for example, can be used, always testing the respective metal for its similarity to these three representative types. And at the same time, we must be clear that the lower region of the human being is related to copper, mercury, and silver, and that we must consider the extent to which we can apply these metals themselves, or related metals, by combining them somehow with processes that form carbonic acid. In this way, we unite three things: the metallic quality, as defined by the extra telluric element working within the earthly element, a quality that is otherwise stony, which takes shape under the influence of the principle that forms carbonic acid, and what takes shape under the influence of the principle that forms salicylic acid. We gradually draw closer to the possibility of discovering concrete external substances that we must introduce into the human organism in order to bring about healing in one or the other case. As we do this, we will always have to note that very high dilutions can be effective if the substance in question has little effect on the lower senses of smell and taste, and therefore does not put its essential nature on display so outwardly, whereas we will need lower dilutions of substances that blatantly present their inner nature to our senses of smell and taste. If we understand their healing aspects clearly, substances with strong smells and tastes are often extremely good remedies in their natural state, especially if their therapeutic effect is not cancelled out by a conventional diet. Admittedly, in order to delve still further into these questions, we must at least be aware that each human sense possesses the power to distinguish differences, and that human subjects are the best reagents, the best means of discovering reactions. Of course, this will be difficult in the case of substances with no pronounced smell or taste. But let me make you aware of a type of self-education that is especially important for physicians. It consists of developing all the subtle sensing capacities that can possibly be developed, the ones that lead us to have sensations even with respect to the external natural process of silica formation or the like. It must be meaningful that quartz, although it always produces very regular formations on its own, is a mineral whose related substances tend toward all kinds of possible crystalline shapes. Enormous variety exists in the crystallization of silicates. Anyone who has a sense for such things also senses that the dispersing element predominates in all their different formative possibilities. A dispersing element must pre-exist if the degree of formative capacity that the silicates possess is to be present in outer nature. This suggests that silicates must be broken apart before they are used. We need to develop the ability to sense this, because this sensing ability leads to a means of evaluating remedies. It is also necessary for each of us to become a good reactive medium in terms of acquiring the sensory abilities to discover that smells are sevenfold, just like sensations of color. If we acquire the ability to distinguish sweetish smells, pungent smells, and so on, we will discover that the sense of smell is differentiated into seven nuances, as is the sense of taste. The interesting point here is that by mastering the spectrum, as it were, or scale of sense, we also acquire a means of learning how to find our way among all the phenomena of combustible substances. We delve into the nature of combustible substances, as it were. Tomorrow we will see how this is done. And if we acquire specific sensory possibilities with regard to taste, so that we can easily distinguish between sweet tastes and the tastes of salts and the five other nuances, then we acquire a certain inner relationship to the salt-forming principle in nature. Having acquired this relationship, we reach the point of being able to sense, in the impressions we receive from nature, that one thing is useful for one aspect of the human organism, another for another aspect. Although we need a firm foundation in careful, precise scientific studies of the effects of various substances, it is still very important for us to unfailingly unite the results of these studies with our own subjective powers of perception, and gain a certain inner feeling of kinship with nature by doing so. Tomorrow I would like to take up again what we have discussed today, and then continue to move closer to the specifics. The end of Lecture 9.